Okay, so picking up, maybe let's review a little bit of where we were yesterday and what we covered. So this slide is of particular interest, slide three. And remember, this is the whole point of the game, right? We're trying to match the laser frequency to the length of the cavity. One thing that I breezed over on this slide last time, and it came up later that I did breeze over it, I had mentioned low finesse and high finesse, but we ended up talking about cavity line width as well, as to how difficult the cavity is to get its frequency resonant. And that's also reflected on this graph here. So a low finesse cavity has a large cavity line width, and it's just defined by the sort of full width half maximum of this curve here. So now the arm cavities in red would have a tight line width like this curve here, a high finesse curve, whereas the arm cavities in green would have a fatter curve here. They have a lower finesse cavity, so it takes less to get the cavity close to resonant condition, which means it takes less to get the PDH signal in its linear range. So a low finesse, large line width cavity has a lot of linear range in its PDH system, whereas a high finesse, small line width cavity has only a small bit of linear range. And then we went through PDH locking. That's slide four. So let's now skip ahead to where we left off yesterday. Ed had a few questions on the acousto-optic modulator here. And he was thinking that somehow the modulation depth defined how much spray was in here or something like that. But I want to emphasize that as soon as you put in a modulated frequency into this crystal, then it will start to create this diffraction pattern. So all of it will be available at all times. And what we do to get to use it as a frequency actuator is to just pick one of these optical paths physically and put a high reflector on one of those paths and then send it back through the AOM. This is kind of why on slide nine, I depict the AOM diagrammatically to have a little bent angle there. This is just to demonstrate that we're using the first harmonic, and you get that upshift in frequency based on the oscillator frequency that you're shoving into the crystal.
I'm guessing we have to dump everything else.
We have to dump everything else, that's right. And the other confusing thing is that an AOM, we use an AOM for an amplitude control as well as a frequency control. Not this particular one, but a different AOM is used to control the power on the intensity stabilization. This is this diffracted power from the AOM that you heard in the chair. So it's also an AOM, but used in a different fashion. Essentially, for the power control, you would pick the central M equals zero so that it has no frequency modulation, and the amount of oscillator stuff in is how much light is spread out away from that. So that's the diffracted power. It's 4% diffracted power. You're controlling the amount of light that's sprayed elsewhere. So there's two ways to use the AOM, which is why it's confusing. Okay, so breezing through the FSS and the mode cleaner, and I'll remind folks in the upper left-hand corner, this is sort of keeping track of where we are in the lock acquisition sequence. And Travis pointed out that he didn't put two and two together that this is part of the lock acquisition, but this stuff isn't covered in like the full ISC lock guardian because it's the sort of stuff that's supposed to be always on. So like the FSS and the IMC PDH are sort of always on and an independent guardian. And then the ALS stuff is also an independent guardian. So this is all in like the very beginning steps of the main interferometer lock acquisition sequence. And it's not until later that we start to get through. So I'm breezing through slides 12, 13, where we have the ALS system locked, we have COM system locked. We all covered this all yesterday. And again, from here, this is where on slide 15, we start to talk about the rest of the lock acquisition sequence. This is where you'll start to see the names in the upper left corner start to directly correspond to the full interferometer lock acquisition sequence. And again, the idea here is we have the arms controlled in green. So we have a probe of what the arms are resonant, or where they would be resonant, but we've intentionally shoved an offset into the length of the arms so that it's intentionally not resonant, so that we can lock DRMI. Okay, and that was the find IR and the IIR found things on page 17 and 16. And say page 18, we have the arms off resonance. And again, in the middle left corner here, we have these intentional offsets that are put into the slow DAC of the frequency control of the PDH loops for COM and STIF. And now here we'll pick up and go back into detail mode. So slide 19, we're on DRMI, and it says 1F3F. And in this step, we are just beginning to use the sensors, and these are at this point temporary sensors for the lock acquisition of the three corner station cavities, the power recycling cavity, Mitch or the Michelson, and the signal recycling cavity. And again, the signal recycling cavity is not shown on here because the diagram is complicated enough, and we're typically focused on the CARM system, which doesn't need to involve the anti-symmetric port. The sensor here for DRMI, there is an AS-AIR signal that's in the not shown port, but there's also this REFL-AIR. And that signal is demodulated in the same sort of PDH fashion with an oscillator demodulating the light and comparing it against the light that has these sidebands put in by the EOM. And then it's fed into an ADC, digitized, and then sent through a control filter to PRM, the beam splitter, and the SRM. And we first lock this on 1F, which is this 9 and 45 megahertz sidebands. And then we will temporarily switch to a harmonic of those frequencies, or 3F, that won't be confused when we bring the arms back into resonance. So let's do a little aside on that and what the heck I mean by that. So slide 20, I had lied to you in the beginning of the presentation on slide 8, when I had made this quick approximation that a Fourier transform of a sine wave that has an amplitude A e to the I omega t that you then add a phase modulation to via the EOM, this I gamma sine omega t. I had told you that it was simply you can approximate that for small modulation depth. Remember, modulation depth is gamma in this case. For small modulation depth, you can do a 1 plus the modulation times the original sine wave. But to be more complete, down there in the middle left, what's actually happening is this original sine wave plus the summation of Bessel functions of the first kind times a sine phase that has the modulation frequency. And this Bessel function of the first kind has a couple of properties. It is equivalent to roughly 1 over k factorial, where k is this integer index, times gamma over 2 to the kth power. These are just like mathematical identities that people just have to know and look up. It's one of those math problems that you solve in your math methods for physics classes that is just excruciating. But what it translates to is that for every sideband with this plus and minus gamma over 2 e to the modulation frequency, you also get a gamma over 4 times twice the modulation frequency, a gamma over 6 times 3 times the modulation frequency. So you actually have this picture that is from Kumamu's thesis in the bottom left corner, that shows the carrier, which is the original e to the lowercase I omega t. And then it has many sidebands that are slowly decreasing in amplitude as you go away by the power of k factorial. And that's just in the electric fields of what comes out of this EOM. Photodetectors measure power, which is the field squared. So you're going to get all sorts of cross terms where it's, you know, omega, capital omega plus two omega and all sorts of weird different combinations. And then, so that's what I have in light gray below that statement, is that you'll have not only 9 megahertz, but twice 9 megahertz, which is 18. You'll have twice times 9 minus 45, which is 27 megahertz. 9 minus 45 is 36. So you have all of these different harmonics and combinations of sidebands on the light as it's detected by this photodiode. And what I show in the plot in the bottom right is one of our length sensing and control photodiodes response to power. And you can see that it has a complicated transfer function, and we specifically tune the circuits for a given photodetector to have resonances on a particular sideband frequency that we really want to control. So, for example, one of the photodiodes, the LSC photodiodes in the anti-symmetric port is REFL. And REFL has sensitivity not only to 9 and 45 megahertz, but it also has some sensitivity to 3 times 9 and 3 times 45 megahertz. So our sensor has the ability to look at multiple sidebands. There'll be a little less power in those sidebands, but they still are measuring the cavity and they still contain information that we can use. And this whole thing that I had mentioned about the arms being resonant and not resonant, there's a whole paper on this written by Koji, where he essentially invented this technique for his thesis. But you see on slide one, what, did the page number start over? Okay, it says page one, but somehow it's page 21. Oh, the plot's probably blocked. Okay. Anyways, it's so this is a cartoon picture of the interferometer, and you recognize the features, right? You have the arms and you have the power recycling cavity, and you have various photodiodes at various ports. They're all PDH photodiodes, and the idea is that if you take a look at this plot in the bottom right corner, there is this plot of Schnupp asymmetry, which is this intentional offset, differential offset that we put between the ITMs in order to leak a little bit of light to the dark port. So we do that, and we fix it for advanced LIGO at 8 centimeters. And so you can see at 8 centimeters, the ratio between the power recycling cavity signal and the CARM signal, which is little delta L plus, and big delta L plus, so the ratio of how these signals interfere with each other at the same photodetector, at the same port, is much more for 3 omega than it is for 1 omega, where 3 omega is the solid line and single omega is the dashed line. So this is saying that if I take this photodetector at the power recycling cavity port, the REFL port, and I look at its 1F signal versus its 3F signal, the 3F will be, you'll get a much more Perkle for a given CARM signal than you would if you're looking at your omega signal. So that means essentially you can move CARM around, and this 3F signal is much less sensitive to that movement of CARM than the 1F signal. So this is the whole point of switching from 1F to 3F, is that the 3F signal is much less sensitive to CARM than the 1F signal. So while it's easy to lock the 1F signal for DRMI because it has a lot of power in the sideband, in the first harmonic, on page 20, the advantage that once you have it locked, you have plenty of signal in the 3F that you can switch over your control system to using that error signal as opposed to your 1F. And that has the advantage of you can move CARM around however you want and it won't blow up and confuse the DRMI signal.
How do we switch from 1F to 3F?
So the photodiode is always reading out 1F and 3F.
Yeah.
Right? So the error signal is essentially always available. So you just tune your control loop such that they both have the same kind of open loop gain and so that it's an easy, smooth transition. And you could measure DRMI with one or the other with equivalency. And then it's just a matter of flipping the switch of which one you're trying to use.
Okay.
You know, I just assume you have to kind of blend it somehow smoother.
Yeah, I mean, you ramp from one to the other, yeah.
Okay. But the idea is that the transfer function between the two look roughly the same,
right?
And so that the transition is smooth by itself.
It's some sort of complement or ramping like the blend ramping.
I don't know. I don't know the details of the blends design. Yeah. I think as far as I can tell, throughout most of the acquisition sequence, it's not as though we're ever using the, well, it must be. I don't think it's as sophisticated as the blend wrapping in the seismic system. But we must at least at some point be able to do like say half and half one and half and half the other. So I think they're just equivalent signals that you can essentially choose how much of each you can choose. And it's not as sensitive as the blend matching is, I don't think, for the seismic system. Okay, so that's the whole aside on 1F versus 3F and why we do it. So now I'm back on slide 22. And we have DRMI on 3F now, and CARM is intentionally held off resonance. So now we're going to play the game of switching to more sensitive sensors that have less dynamic range, right? Because we already have some control of the interferometer. It's not flopping around as though it was free. So we have some control, so we can switch to sensors that have lower dynamic range. So the first one of these on slide 23 is CARM on TR. So we bring the arms in a little bit to resonance. That's what this CARM 150 picometers is. So the arms are a little bit on resonance, and that means a little bit of light starts to show up on the trans sensors at the back end of the arms. And then the diagram, they're called FY subtrans and FX subtrans, and they're the red light that's coming off the back of the ETM. So that light is digitized in ADCs at the end station, but then it's shipped to the corner station. And you can see right where the REFL air gets demodulated and pulls in to the ADC. This is digital space here. And you see this little indicator that's square root of TRX plus TRY. It's got to be square root because what comes out of a photodetector is a power. And we want the amplitude error signal. And we're taking the average of it. And this is also normalized by like the power in the laser and all that sort of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of coefficients in there that aren't shown, but the message is that it's the square root of TRX plus TRY. And that is then used as an equivalent error signal to CARM that we can then swap back and forth between COM, C-O-M-M, and CARM, C-A-R-M. So CARM is now controlled on TR or transmission at with the arms at a 150 picometers detuned. And then we transition DARM, and this talk doesn't really cover DARM or anything in the anti-symmetric port like I said earlier with DARM and Mitch and Circle, but there's an in-air in-air RFPD called ASAIR. And you can use it to measure DARM with IR, and it's the same kind of PDH kind of servo there where you take the light picked off at the anti-symmetric port, you demodulate it at the right frequency, and you get an error signal. The same stuff is happening on the DARM side of thing, but this is just not the focus of this talk. But the point here is that we also transition DARM to RF control, just like we've switched COM to RF control. The transmitted photodiodes are not RF yet. But anyways, in this process, we are also reducing the CARM offset a little bit more. This is once we transition DARM to RF, the CARM is also continually being reduced to 5 picometers here. And then on the next slide, 25, then is when we can switch to using REFL in vacuum for CARM. So this reflected light off of the PRM is then picked off, bounced around through the Faraday, just like the REFL air. There's just a little beam splitter in vacuum that then steers some of the light to the vacuum version of this REFL sensor. And then again, it's the same thing. You demodulate it at the right frequency, and then you feed it into an ADC. And in this case, we are still using this, what's called the summing node, to bring in various CARM signals and switch to and from between them. And at this point, we're still using a digitized version, so a slow 16 kilohertz version of REFL in vacuum that then gets piped into the CARM board and then cascades down into the IMC board, which then controls the PSL, which controls the AOM, and et cetera, cascading down, changing laser frequency. So the COM is a noisy high range sensor. The transmitted light from the end station is a less noisy and has less range, but it works, and it's a viable transition between the COM and REFL. So we finally do switch over to CARM on REFL in this step here. It's still not good enough frequency noise, though. Remember, we're trying to get 10 orders of magnitude suppression. And then finally, we have the arms on resonance. So you can see over the last couple of slides, the red arms have been coming in on resonance. So we have the CARM offset is completely reduced. So down in the middle left corner over here, we see that there's no longer any CARM offset. And we have the frequency controlled to be on the IR frequency. Although we're not really using CARM at this point anymore, we're using REFL vacuum to control these things. But that's it. We now have the entire interferometer on resonance, and it was brought there in a controlled fashion. And the arms are no longer detuned. And we also, at this stage, switch our control of CARM to be completely analog. So instead of having the vacuum REFL ports being sent through the ADC and into the DAC and the summing board, we switch to a, on slide 27, we switch to a completely analog signal. And again, we want to do analog here so that we can get a giant bandwidth on our control loop well above the traditional 16 kilohertz sampling frequency. So that we can get a lot of suppression of that frequency noise. So here is where we really start to get the entire frequency control system up and running and suppressing the frequency noise down to the level that we need in order to make the advanced LIGO sensitivity. And then finally, the last couple of steps were basically transitioning to final sensors and shutting off things we don't need anymore. And so on slide 27, we are switching DRMI no longer to the in-air version of REFL, but we now have a pickoff port that is picking off the transmitted light from PR3 through PR2, bouncing around the same path that ALS had bounced. And that has an in-vacuum photodiode that is picking off what is called the pick-off port for power recycling cavity, or POP. So this is further improving the DRMI noise because we're now switching to an in-vacuum sensor as well. And then on slide 28, we park the ALS VCO, and that is Again, if you look at the middle left here where CARM is happening, we're no longer using any of the signals from CARM, from COM or DIF, and we're intentionally shoving an offset into those oscillators so that they're not swimming around and interacting with the IMC VCO, which is still using, which is still going on. Maybe you've heard of these whistles that the detector characterization group has talked about over time. That's exactly what these are, right? They are oscillators, RF oscillators, that are sort of moving around uncontrolled a little bit by maybe hundreds of hertz or something like that. And remember, these are megahertz oscillators, so that's some tiny percent of their actually controlled frequency. So they're swimming around, and they, you know, there's cables that are going from here to there all throughout the interferometer, so they're going to mix with each other. And the idea with this step is that you intentionally rail the VCOs for ALS diff and ALS COM such that they are parked and saturated and only producing exactly one frequency. And so they are put out of the way of any other still active oscillators. And then finally on slide 29 is where we shutter ALS. And this is literally just putting a in vacuum controlled beam diverter in the way of any green light going into the vacuum system. So the green light disappears from the vacuum system. And it's not really that the ALS system fundamentally could couple with the interferometer, but it's a sort of backscatter issue and having stuff around that you don't necessarily need is why we shutter ALS into the vacuum system. Okay, and then that covers the entire diagram. And I promised you at the beginning of yesterday that you could understand this diagram now. So hopefully at least it's a little bit more clear and all the functions of all of the bits are, that makes sense. And you understand all of this acronym list.
Not a good test, is there?
Nope. I mean, your test is back in the control room,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Where is the EOM here? Oh, you mean that's the question. Gotcha. Okay, so then let's talk a little bit more about modeling and loop noise and things like this. Not in too much detail, but just to show this thing as Evan Hall did in his thesis, sort of covering all of the elements in variables so that you can do some math on it and predict the noise. So here I'm on slide 31, and I'm going to start on the left. And this G of F here is the FSS. So this is this internal loop here that, you know, measures the frequency of the laser with the beat note at that tiny FSS REFL photodiode coming off the reference cavity. And then that's picked off and fed through the control system, and then directly controls the laser again. So this G is the open loop gain of the FSS as itself. And now everything else is a nested spaghetti monster on top of that, right? So as you come along the bottom and the frequency noise of the laser shoots along and then enters into the interferometer, either through the common arm degree of freedom along the bottom, which is P, or through the IMC, which is K. And you can see if we follow the IMC path, it converts, the IMC converts the frequency noise coming into it, and then it has an interferometric response to that frequency noise because it's equivalent to a length change. And then that light from that gets picked off and converted into a voltage, which then gets fed following up now along the top into the AOM, and then that AOM then controls the frequency of light and shifts the frequency of light on the FSS servo. So there's that first stage of nested control, right? You have the IMC which then overrides or adds to the frequency control of the FSS. And then similarly, along the bottom, following the P path, The interferometer also has a response to frequency noise. It's a much better measure of that frequency noise because it has a much longer cavity. But similarly, at that REFL photodiode, there's a voltage that gets picked off. And then just like on the previous diagram, this cascading CARM board and IMC board path, this fast and slow paths, you know, one, the CARM board has the slow path that then gets added into the mode cleaner at the input of K. And then the fast path gets fed directly to the PSL VCO, which is already getting signal from the mode cleaner, which then controls the AOM and then goes back to the laser frequency. This is a sort of very simplified variable version of how all of the loops are nested and interrelated to each other. There's another path that we don't talk about typically, there's a whole other talk about it or document about it, is this tidal path, this capital T of F. At very, very, very low frequency, the reference cavity temperature is monitored and predicted what's the effect on the frequency would be, right? We know the moon orbiting around the Earth is going to cause tides, and we can predict that via orbital mechanics, and therefore we can predict how much tidal shift there should be within a diurnal cycle. So we predict that ahead of time and then feed that to the test. So this is this tidal path. There's more details in the paper that I mentioned. So anyways, on slide 32, we show the open loop gains. And you'll remember what the open loop gain means from our controls class. This is the amount of authority that the control loop has to suppress whatever noise it's trying to suppress. And these are again from Evan's thesis. And from the FSS on the right, it has a unity gain frequency of 300 kilohertz, roughly. You can see that there's, you know, some features and some squiggles in there, but we'll call it 300 kilohertz. And that has suppression in the detection band at around 100 hertz of about 1,000. And then the IMC in the middle has an open loop gain of about 30 kilohertz. And that in the detector band around 100 hertz has a suppression of about 10 to the 4. And then finally, the CARM loop has a UGF of about 15 kilohertz. And at 100 hertz, that's another factor of 1,000. And if you multiply all of those together, then you get the 10 orders of magnitude suppression that we needed at the beginning of the talk. That's it.
I think the IMC over gain is a bit higher.
Yeah, I mean, these things are good too, about a factor or two. They change because the optical plant changes a lot, right? Because the arm cavities alignments change, the power going into these cavities change. That's going to change the cavity's response to frequency noise. So it's going to change your plant in your control system up and down in gain by a little bit, which means the unity gain frequency, if you keep your controller fixed, is going to shift around. Which is why Craig always has to go out there and measure it and check what it is to make sure that it's okay.
I thought it was on the order of 100.
No, it's not that much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that could be true.
I guess it depends on their.
Yeah, you can allocate your gain.
Yeah.
Among these three loops in various different ways, depending on, you know, for example, the notches and resonances in the FSS loop are related to the PZT on the laser. They're related to the reference cavity electronics nonsense. So there's lots of features in there that could be different from site to site, which may be why Livingston could get potentially more gain out of their FSS than we could or something like that. So a lot of it has to do with the details of the implementation. But the overall goal is to, among these three loops, we need to at least get over 10 orders of magnitude.
So you did almost all length.
What?
All
all like the group, like mostly like the Greens and Freedom today and yesterday.
The focus was CARM.
CARM, that's it.
And getting that acquisition sequence and understanding it and trying to demystify it from Danielle's. And more importantly, as I was saying at the beginning, you know, the system spans, you know, many different what we call traditional subsystems of PSL, IO, and ISC, and it's been designed over decades. And so trying to find the one document that really explains it very well didn't exist, in my humble opinion, before I put this together.
Yeah. I was just more wondering like whether or not you're gonna do this. ASC.
Maybe I can do that. Give me another 2 years. but I think I'll call it there and open the floor to questions if there are any others. But I think I'm done.
Can I
ask a
second to the last one. Evan's
thesis. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This one?
Yeah. Is that the green block that I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, like, do you have a feel for how big that signal is, or small, or
what the crossover frequency is?
I'm just wondering.
As in, how much length control we push on a movement?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not in real numbers, but in like sort of maybe relative numbers, maybe would be a better.
So I can say that the crossover frequency for the CARM feedback to the mode cleaner is only about 30 hertz or so. So in terms of how much it pushes the mode cleaner around in length, I know we... That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I could probably find this out by converting some of the signals, but I haven't. Okay. The number that comes closest to answering that question is the crossover.
Uh-huh.
Let me know. Do you have an idea?
I'm trying to think. I think I know.
I also know the extremes of it, right? The tidal control pushes the arms on the order of a millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be somewhere between a millimeter. I mean, what's really happening is that we need the slow path to push the mode cleaner length so that we can control the microsupply. Because the PSL VCO doesn't have enough actuation range to control the length noise cap. So we need to actually physically push on the mirror because the OSMs have much bigger range, equivalent range, than the one
Okay.
Yeah, it is 10 to the minus 12, yeah, 10 hertz times the, is it triple pendulum?
Mm-hmm.
So divided by 10 to a third or so meters, maybe it's around the range.
10 to a third meters?
and fourth, sixth.
You get a minus? You got a minus in there?
Minus, yeah. Divided by 10 to the 6.
Okay.
Meters.
Yeah, so about micro size.